moment, I say, my heart sinking, wondering if it has anything to do with Melanie's voicemail. I'd rather not discuss it over the phone, Walter says. Okay, I say. Then ask if he's talked to Kirk. No, I called you first, he says. Thank you, I say. Then tell him that I'll be there just as soon as I can. 20 minutes and several traffic violations later, I park in front of Windsor and run into the school. I have a meeting with Mr. Quarterman, I tell Sharon at the front desk. He's expecting me. She nods and tries to hand me that damn sign-in clipboard, but I blow her off, muttering that I'm already late and dashing down the hallway. When I arrive at Walter's office, I knock, then walk into a small crowd of people. Walter is behind his desk, and in front of him, in a semicircle of chairs, sit Finch, Tom, Polly, and Polly's parents. My stomach drops as Walter stands to greet me, then points to the only remaining free chair, which happens to be right next to my son. As I sit, I acknowledge Tom, Polly, and her parents with a nod, glancing at Finch last. Everyone looks relatively composed, except Polly. Will Kirk be joining us? Walter asks. No, he won't be, I say. Can you tell me what's going on? Walter nods. Yes, as I told you on the phone, Nina. There's been a development, and unfortunately we have two very different versions of the story. Polly lets out a sob, covering her face with her hands, as her father puts his arm around her and softly shushes her. Can someone please cut to the chase, I say. Sure thing, Tom snaps, his voice cold and livid. Someone wrote slut on our porch. Oh my God, I say. I'm so sorry. Tom ignores this and simply says, Finch says Polly did it. Out of the corner of my eye, I can see Finch nodding, while Polly wails in protest. It wasn't me, I swear. Her father tries to soothe her again as Tom continues. Whether or not the artwork is, in fact, Polly's, she did call Lila a slut yesterday at your house. Polly admits this much is true, which is really lovely. She's very sorry for using that word, Polly's dad says, but she had nothing to do with your porch being vandalized. She was home all night with us. Walter attempts to cut in, but Tom talks right over him. Now Finch is also saying that he didn't actually take the infamous photo of Lila, that actually Polly took it, and he's been covering for her all this time. That's not true, Polly yells, her face covered with tears and snot. It's a total lie. You're the one lying, Finch says, perfectly calmly. Walter sighs and says, well, hopefully tomorrow's proceedings will bring some clarity. Clarity? Tom shouts. The only clarity I see is that my daughter is getting victimized left and right, and somebody here is lying. Maybe both of them are. Maybe this whole thing is an elaborate plot to make sure no one gets blamed. I can assure you, Mr. Volpe, that's not what is happening here, Polly's dad says. My daughter has admitted to calling your daughter a terrible name, but what? Tom fires back. But no big deal? Tom, please, I know it's hard, but please try to calm down, Walter says. Don't you dare tell me to calm down. This is a circus, a total circus. Tom stands suddenly, nearly knocking over his chair, before storming to the door. Someone get my daughter out of class, now. Walter looks completely rattled as he grabs his phone, dials an extension, and says, Can you please have Lila Volpe report to the front entrance? Yes, right away, please. Meanwhile, Tom is out the door, slamming it behind him. I jump, my heart racing, as I make eye contact with Finch. He stares back at me, with his hand over his heart. I swear, Mom, he whispers, I didn't do it.
Chapter 25. Tom. I don't know if I've waited 3 seconds or 3 minutes, but when Lila doesn't immediately materialize in the lobby, I start pounding on the ledge of the check-in desk, yelling at that smug receptionist and demanding that I get my daughter now. I even make a move down the hall in the general direction of the high school classrooms. Mr. Volpe, you can't go down there. The receptionist stands up in a panic, as if I were an armed intruder. Sure enough, her voice trembles as she adds that she is going to have to push a button for the police if I take another step. I stop, turn, and walk back over to her. Please, don't pretend you don't know what's going on around here, because I'm pretty sure you know everything that's going on around here. I pound my hand on her ledge one more time for good measure, just as Lila rounds the corner and rushes toward me, looking mortified.
Dad, what are you doing?
She says as I catch the receptionist staring nosily at us over her reading glasses. Come on, we're leaving right now.
I can't leave, Dad,
she says, glancing around, looking desperate.
I'm in the middle of a science quiz, and I don't even have my stuff.
Now, I yell. She starts to protest again, but I turn around and walk out the front door. I am nervous about what I'll do if she doesn't follow me. I feel pretty sure that it would involve that woman's panic button. Fortunately, we don't have to find out, because a few seconds later, I hear Lila's footsteps on the pavement behind me. I only walk faster, my strides getting longer. By the time Lila climbs in the car beside me, she is completely unhinged, crying so hard that she is starting to hyperventilate. Part of me wants to put my arms around her and calm her down. But my anger, along with my desire to get the fuck out of Belmead, outweighs any sense of compassion. So I start driving, passing countless motherfuckers in Range Rovers and BMWs and Mercedes. What in the world was I thinking, sending my daughter to this neighborhood every day with these soulless, money-worshipping, lying sons of bitches? Why didn't I learn my lesson when I was a bag boy at the Belmead Country Club, when I slept with Delaney and realized that she was using me as her pawn, a sick way to make a point to her daddy and her bullshit high society? Well, Lila has become a pawn, too, and I'm not going to allow it any longer. Effective today, my child will not be attending that godforsaken school. No education is worth all of this. I mean, what's the end game? An elitist education gets you what exactly? An elitist group of friends and a jackass husband like Kirk Browning? Fuck that. I'd rather Lila grow up and live paycheck to paycheck like I do than turn out anything like these people. I'd rather she be lonely and alone than lonely with them. Us versus them. It is the drumbeat in my head as I drive. The entrance to 440 looks jammed, so I keep going through town, hitting stoplight after stoplight, Lila's tears never letting up. Every few minutes I think of Quarterman and Nina and know that I am brushing with too broad a stroke. Then again, they are right in the mix, playing the goddamn game. I mean, how could Quarterman run a school like Windsor if he weren't drinking the Kool-Aid on all that bullshit? And I really like Nina. I can't help myself. But her son is shady. Maybe he didn't take the picture or write on our porch, but he definitely lied at some point, and at Lila's expense. Dad, slow down! Lila screams as I nearly slam into the back of a black Lexus. I hit my brakes just in time, my heart pounding, my hands sweaty on the steering wheel. Sorry, I say under my breath, telling myself to get a grip, to get help. Then I think of Bonnie and make a left where I should make a right.
Where are you going?
Lila stops crying just long enough to ask me. To see a friend, I say.
What friend?
She asks. The question is telling. She thinks I have none. Without answering, I keep driving, weaving my way through historic Belmont, until I get to Bonnie's quaint old Foursquare, her ancient Volvo station wagon, covered with bumper stickers is sitting in her driveway at a virtual diagonal. If it were any other day, her parking effort would have made me smile.
"Dad, whose house is this?"
Lila says. She is still upset, but her curiosity has dampened her hysteria. "I told you, my friend's house," I say, parking behind the Volvo. "Her name is Bonnie. I sometimes talk to her about things. About you. Come on and meet her." We both step out of the car and close our doors as Lila trails behind me to the front door.
"Are you dating her?"
she asks, wiping her nose on her sleeve. At that second, Bonnie appears through the glass door panes, wearing enormous glasses and a weird shawl that looks more like a blanket. Her gray hair is wilder than usual. I catch a fleeting look of disappointment in Lila's eyes.
"Well, hello there, Tommy boy," Bonnie says as she opens the door.
"Morning, Bonnie," I say. "Sorry for the surprise visit."
"Well, it's a nice surprise, Tommy. A very nice surprise," she says, looking past me. "And you must be Lila."
Her expression becomes even warmer.
"Yes, ma'am,"
Lila says, forcing the mandatory tight-lipped smile that comes with an introduction to an adult.
"How positively wonderful to meet you. I'm Bonnie," she says,
one hand appearing from the depths of the shawl. She shakes Lila's hand, then pulls her into a half-hug.
"Come in, sweetie."
As Lila takes a step into the house and I follow, we are bombarded by the smell of baking, though I can't identify the exact scent. Maybe cinnamon? By now, I can see that Lila is intrigued not only with the concept of me having a friend, but with Bonnie herself. For once, it feels like I made a decision that my daughter and I can agree is the right one. Bonnie leads us onto her back sun porch, which is drenched in morning light and decorated with jewel-toned upholsteries. I take an emerald chair, and Lila chooses the sapphire blue one across from me.
"May I make you a cup of mint tea?"
Bonnie asks in her musical voice, which almost sounds Irish.
"It's delicious."
We both nod and watch her walk back toward the kitchen. Neither of us speaks for several minutes. We just sit there and wait until Bonnie returns with a small wooden tray. On it are three steaming teacups on mismatched saucers, along with pink happy birthday napkins. The tray also holds a miniature pitcher of milk and a bowl filled with sugar cubes that remind me of Lila's tea set when she was little. Lila and I each take a cup before Bonnie places the tray on a wicker chest doubling as a coffee table. She then sits on the red chair beside Lila's, sharing her view of the backyard. She points out the window, up into the trees. My back is to the window, but I know what they're looking at.
"Do you see that marvelous treehouse?" Bonnie asks Lila.
She nods, looking transfixed.
"You know who built it?"
Bonnie says, slowly stirring two lumps of sugar into her cup. She makes that tinkling spoon-on-china sound that is hypnotic.
"My dad?"
Lila guesses. Bonnie smiles, nods, and taps her spoon on the edge of the cup before placing it back on the tray. "Yes, your dad. I'm biased, but I have to say, it's the best treehouse in all of Tennessee. Maybe anywhere." As Lila smiles back at her, my heart floods.
"So, tell me," Bonnie says, furrowing her brow and putting on her shrink face. "Why aren't you at school?"
Lila puts her cup down on her saucer, then says,
"Ask my dad that question. He's the one who made me leave in the middle of a science quiz."
She glares at me.
"Does this have anything to do with the photo taken of you at the party?"
Bonnie asks, looking directly at Lila. I give her bonus points for being so straightforward. Lila nods, then quickly and adamantly insists that Finch's ex-girlfriend took that photo and that he is innocent, completely innocent. Without addressing her claims, I fill in a few important blanks, namely Lila's visit to Finch yesterday and our vandalized porch. Lila says Polly did that too, then finishes with an account of this morning's episode in the school lobby, calling it humiliating and accusing me of always making things so much worse than they have to be. So Finch is innocent, and I'm the bad guy, I say, Bonnie's soothing effect starting to wear off. Dad, I was in the middle of a test. You said it was a quiz. Same difference. Bonnie gives her a compassionate nod, then says, Okay, so, Lila, how would you have preferred your dad handle this situation today? Lila sighs, then gives a long-winded, rambling answer, covering everything from the orange paint on my clothing to the way I was shouting in the lobby. Like, couldn't he have just called my headmaster and not made a huge scene covered in paint? Bonnie looks at me. Do you understand how she feels? Sure, I guess, I say. And she's right that I shouldn't have lost my temper. But I had to do something, and sometimes it feels as if Lila is more concerned with little details and appearances than the big picture. For example, I really don't think it matters that I have a little paint on my clothes. Bonnie gives me a hint of a smile, then looks at Lila again. Do you know what he's trying to say? Lila shrugs, then grants Bonnie the same answer I gave her. I guess. Bonnie clears her throat and continues. And don't you think he's trying to do the best he can to help you? Yes, but this actually isn't helping me. Lila says, at all. He has no clue what it's like to be me. And this is my school, he's barging into. My world.
Not for long, it isn't, I say under my breath.
Lila makes a loud huffing sound, points at me, and says to Bonnie,
See? See, he wants me to leave my school over this. Tell him that's ridiculous. And so unfair. This isn't Windsor's fault.
Okay, but do you understand why your father feels some animosity toward Windsor? After all, someone from the school took that photograph of you, and no one has yet been punished for it.
All these days later, Bonnie says, articulating the reasons for my anger and frustration so beautifully and succinctly that I want to high-five or hug her.
Yeah, okay, I get that, Lila says. And I appreciate that he's a really good father and stuff. But he's always so angry at everyone. It's like he thinks the whole world is against us or something. And they're not. They're just not.
The truth of her statement hits me hard, and I feel them both staring at me as I catch my breath.
Tom?
Bonnie says softly.
Yeah? I ask, my head spinning.
Does Lila have a point here?
I slowly nod. Yeah, she does. Holding my gaze, Lila says,
I mean, Dad, some people in Bellmead do suck. Some people are huge snobs and look down on us. But a lot of them aren't like that at all. Some of them are just like us, only with more money. And if money and appearances and stuff like that don't matter, then they shouldn't matter either way.
She looks so earnest and emboldened. I nod again, hearing her and feeling the truth of her words on a deeper level than I thought possible.
I just want you to trust me sometimes, she continues. to make my own judgments about people, which might not be the same as yours, whether that's Grace or Finch or anyone else. And yeah, I'm going to make mistakes, but now it's time to trust me. If I mess up, I mess up. But I want and need your faith in me.
Okay, I say, nodding and blinking back unexpected tears. I'll try. And Lila, Bonnie says, you'll try too? To cut him some slack? And understand how hard it must be to raise you on his own?
Yes,
Lila says, first looking at Bonnie, then shifting her gaze to me.
I'll try too. I promise, Dad.
Her answer pushes me close to the edge of crying, though I manage to keep it together by taking a sip of tea.
Well, Bonnie says, this is a really good start.
Yeah, I say.
Yeah,
Lila echoes. Now, Bonnie says briskly, what do you say we take a little tour of the world's finest treehouse?
Chapter 26. Nina. After Tom's grand exit, Walter dismisses Finch for the rest of the day, instructing him to return to school in the morning for his scheduled hearing. I don't speak to him until we get outside, telling him to go straight home, that I'll meet him there. Finch nods, then turns toward the student lot while I walk straight ahead to my car. I get in, put on my seatbelt, and take a few deep breaths. Before I start the ignition, I make myself call Kirk, knowing that I can't drive and talk at the same time. Not to him. Not about this. Hey, he says, with what I can tell is forced cheer. Where have you been? I thought Finch told you, I say. I went to Bristol. Yeah, he told me. What gives? What gives? I say. I mean, why did you go home? He asks, as I see Finch's Mercedes appear in my rearview mirror. He drives past me, then up to the front gate, and makes a right turn toward home. To see my parents, and Julie, I say. Okay. Well, why didn't you call me? He asks. I was just really busy. I needed to get away. Kirk, we have to talk. All right, he says. How about dinner tonight? Just the two of us. No. Now. I actually need you to come home right now. Finch and I are on our way. Walter just asked him to leave school for the day. What? Why? What's going on? He says. I finally have his full attention, and not some patronizing portion of it. I'll see you at home, Kirk. I'm not doing this over the phone. Somehow Kirk beats me home from his office. Damn it, I say under my breath. I pull into my usual spot in front, then run inside before they have time to get their story straight. Clearly, they are doing exactly that when I walk into Kirk's office. In mid-sentence, Finch suddenly stops talking, as they both stare up at me. Did I interrupt something? I say, feeling as sick as I did when I read the email exchange with Bob Tate. No, Kirk says, of course not. He walks toward me, as if to hug me, and says, nice to see you too. I take a step back and say, Kirk, I need you to tell me the truth. For once. He blinks, chuckles, then says, what are you talking about now? You tell me, I say, then turn my gaze to Finch. Or our son can tell me. Mom, Finch begins to say, I told you the truth. No, Finch, I say as loudly as I can without actually yelling. You did not. Finch glances furtively at Kirk, who paces back over toward the fireplace and leans on the paneled wall. Kirk, I say, do you have anything you want to tell me? Maybe something about those concert tickets? Honey, please, Kirk says, because of course he'll never just confess. Not unless he knows for a fact that he's been busted. Maybe not even then. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about Bob Tate and the 4 tickets to see Luke Bryan that Beau allegedly paid for. Kirk and Finch exchange a fleeting look that causes something inside me to snap. Stop lying to me, both of you, I yell, fighting back tears of desperation and anger. I stare at Kirk, then Finch, then back at Kirk. Only one of them looks the slightest bit contrite, and it isn't the man I married.
I'm sorry, Mom, Finch says, running his hand through his hair.
I just wanted to... What you wanted, I say. See, that's just it. It's always about what you and your father want. Finch closes his mouth, then bites his lip. I'm sorry, he says again, this time in a whisper. I cut my eyes to Kirk and say, how could you do this? To him, to me, to our family.
Do what?
He has the audacity to ask me. Let him go to a concert with a girl he likes? I swallow and shake my head. No. How can you teach him to be this kind of person?
Mom,
Finch interjects with a note of desperation that makes him seem a good 3 years younger than he is. It gives me a pang in my chest that physically hurts. I raise my brow, waiting.
I promise you, Mom, he continues to plead. I swear to you, I'm not lying about the picture and Polly. I didn't take the picture. She did.
So let me get this straight, I say, staring at my son. You were lying the night of the party, and on the Monday after the party in Mr. Quarterman's office, and the day of the concert when you said Beau got the tickets, but you aren't lying now? Finch nods and says, yeah, Mom, that's correct. So what changed? I say, desperately wanting to believe him.
Well, I've been doing a lot of thinking, and Mom, I was trying to do the right thing all along, he stammers. I only wanted those tickets so I could show Lila how I feel about her, and Dad knew that. That's why he let me go.
Out of the corner of my eye, I can see Kirk nodding, his son having just made a solid closing argument. I feel both of them staring at me, awaiting my reply.
Well, I say, do you know that your father tried to bribe Mr. Volpe?
Nina, Kirk says, that's enough.
I shake my head. No, Kirk, he should know this, I say, looking at Finch again. Did you know your father gave Tom Volpe $15,000 so that he'd make this honor council hearing go away? Finch hesitates, just long enough to give himself away. He already knows. He was in on that, too. Never mind, I say, amazed that my disgust could still be growing. Although, while we're on the topic, Kirk, Tom gave back your money.
That guy's a loser,
Kirk replies under his breath. No, Kirk. Tom Volpe is far from a loser. He's a good person and a great father raising a wonderful young woman who, for some reason, really likes our son.
For some reason, Kirk says. Wow, Nina, that's real nice.
I take a deep breath. Can we speak privately for a moment? I ask Kirk. He nods, then follows me to our bedroom, surprising me with the first thing out of his mouth.
Look, Nina, I'm really sorry.
What are you sorry for, Kirk? The bribe? The lies about the concert? Or being unfaithful to me?
Unfaithful? Kirk says,
way overreacting with the most shocked, indignant look I've ever seen from him.
Why would you say that? What's gotten into you lately? You're not acting like yourself at all.
I know, I say. I haven't been acting like myself for several years now. Not since I let you turn me into some Belle Meade trophy wife.
Trophy wife, he scoffs. We've been together since college. What are you talking about?
You know what I'm talking about, Kirk. I'm an accessory. That's how you see me. Our whole life is so phony and fake. I'm done with it.
Done with what exactly? He shouts back at me. Our beautiful homes, our trips, our lifestyle.
Yes,
all of the above, but mostly
I'm done with you, Kirk. with your fucked up priorities, your lies, your ego and bullshit, the example you've set for our son.
Our son? You mean how he's a really good kid who just got accepted to Princeton? That kind of example?
Oh, God. Enough of the good kid routine. Please, Kirk. Good kids don't scheme against their mothers. Good kids don't lie right in the faces of their headmasters.
He did that to cover for Polly. It was chivalrous.
I don't think so, Kirk, I say, my doubts finally crystallizing. I'm not saying Finch took the picture, but there is more to the story than he's telling us. At least more than he's telling me, and I just can't be on board with this dynamic any longer. I want a divorce. As Kirk stares at me, mouth agape, it occurs to me that there is actually one thing he could say to change my heart, at least a little. He could tell me that I'm right, or at least that he's sorry. Genuinely, this time. Instead, he looks right through me and says, I think you're making a really big mistake, but if this is what you truly want, then I won't try to stop you. I shake my head and feel tears start to pour down my face. You know what, Kirk? Teddy, at age 19, protested more than this when I broke up with him in college. Kirk rolls his eyes and says, well, I'm sure you could still get him back if you wanted to. Maybe, I say, because he really loved me. But I don't want Teddy back. I just want myself back. And my son. If it's not too late. 25 minutes later, I've crossed the river, and I'm driving through the bungalow-lined streets of what used to be Nashville streetcar suburb. I didn't memorize the Volpe's address from our last visit, but I remember how to get there. Down Ordway and a left on Avondale. When I arrive, I pull past their house and park on the other side of the street. As I'm about to get out of the car, Melanie calls me. Before I can think better of it, I answer. Finally, she says, sounding frantic but relieved. What the heck is going on? What do you mean? I say, wondering what exactly she's referring to and how much she knows. I mean with Polly. I heard that she was the one who took the photo after all, and then she called Lila a slut and vandalized her porch. Where did you hear that? I asked, marveling once again at how quickly gossip spreads. Bo, he just texted from school. Said he heard y'all just had a meeting with Walter, and that Polly and her parents and Tom Volpe were there, too. I tell her she's correct. Bo also told me that Walter's questioning kids today, bringing them in one by one. It sounds like he's on a rampage, a total witch hunt. I'm panicked that he's going to suspend more of them for drinking. Maybe, I say, or maybe he's just trying to get to the bottom of what happened. It's coming down to a he said, she said. Yeah, but it's clear Polly had a motive. Jealousy, pure and simple. I don't know, Mel, I say, as I survey the scene of the crime. At least, one of the crimes. The Volpe's house is set on a rather steep hill, two flights of concrete steps leading up from the street to the front porch, a small grassy landing in between. There is no cover whatsoever, and it would take nerves of steel to climb all those steps and vandalize an exposed porch so close to the street. I just can't see Polly doing this. Melanie sighs, clearly annoyed. The picture or the porch? Either. I wasn't at the party and I wasn't home last night, I say. I was in Bristol with my parents. But wasn't Kirk home? She asks. Wouldn't he know if Finch left your house? You would think, but maybe Finch sneaked out. Or maybe Kirk just looked the other way. He's not exactly reliable these days, I say. I then ask her if she knew that the boys went to the Luke Bryan concert with Lila and her friend. She hesitates, then says yes. She did. I'm sorry I didn't tell you, but Kirk told me not to mention it, because you'd say no, and I thought it was a sweet gesture. I'm sorry. I almost tell her that I can't believe she lied to me, but I actually can. I'm suddenly as done with her as I am with Kirk, thinking that Julie would never in a million years conspire with anyone against me, and certainly not with Kirk. Nina, Melanie asks, as I see Tom and Lila pull up to the curb on the other side of the street. Are you still there? Yeah, I say, watching his father and daughter get out of their car and walk up to the front door, neither of them noticing me. Honey, we're just trying to save you from yourself. Please don't take this the wrong way, she continues, which is almost always a precursor to an insult. But you're so irrational these days. I mean, why would Finch vandalize her property when he's already going to the Honor Council? I don't know. To frame Polly, I say, desperately hoping that that's not the case. Melanie continues to tell me how unstable I sound, how worried she is about me, how nothing is more important than our boys. I can't hear another word of it. I tell her that I have to go, and that, for the record, I could think of a few things that are just as important. Maybe more. Like what? Like honesty and truth and character, I say. Oh, my God, Nina, she says. It's like you think you're better than all of us. Better than who, I say, really wanting to know. Your husband and all of your friends. At least I thought we were your friends. Yeah, I say. I really thought so, too.
Chapter 27. Lila. A few minutes after we get home from visiting Dad's friend Bonnie, who I never even knew existed before today, Mrs. Browning shows up at our house. Dad's back in his bedroom, so I answer the door, feeling reassured to know that he actually has friends. Hi, Lila, she says, looking and sounding frazzled. She's wearing almost no makeup and workout clothes, her hair in a messy ponytail. Hi, Mrs. Browning, I say. Would you like to come in? Yes, please. I'd really like to talk to you and your dad, she says, just as he appears in the hallway behind me. I brace myself for a tense exchange, but Bonnie's calming effect seems to have lingered, because he just says hello and asks her to come in. Then we all walk into the living room. The two of them sit on the sofa, and I take Dad's chair. Mrs. Browning speaks first, staring down at her hands. I'm so sorry about everything that's happening. She looks up at my dad, then turns her gaze to me. It's okay, I say, betting that Dad will correct me, and announce that it's not okay. But he doesn't, saying only, Thank you, Nina. Yeah, I say. Thanks. Mrs. Browning takes a deep breath, then says, May I ask you something, Lila? I nod, staring back at her. Who do you think took that photo of you? Finch or Polly? I hesitate, not because I have any doubts whatsoever, but because I know she or my dad will probably ask for my reasons next, and it's really hard to put everything into words. Go ahead, Lila. Tell her what you think, Dad says. I think Polly took it, I blurt out. And I think she wrote that word on our porch, too. I think she's done everything out of jealousy because she knew she was losing Finch, and now she's lost him. For good. My cheeks burn as I say the last part, picturing what Finch and I did in his basement, and knowing Polly has very good reason to be jealous. I don't dare look over at Dad, for fear that he'll be able to figure that last part out. But weren't they still dating on the night of the party? Mrs. Browning asks, looking so worried and confused. When the photo was taken? Technically, I guess, I say with a shrug, acknowledging to myself that maybe Finch's version of the story doesn't completely add up. But then I remember the way he looked at me when I was standing in Beau's kitchen, and it all makes sense again. Dad and Mrs. Browning wait for me to say more, but when I don't, they look at each other instead. It's almost as if they're having a conversation with their eyes. Not the kind that Finch and I have had. More of a, we're in this bullshit together type gaze. I take the opportunity to stand and slip out of the room, feeling immense relief when neither of them tries to stop me. A few seconds later, I'm alone again. I close my door, find my phone, and climb into my bed. All I want to do is talk to Finch. I feel certain that he has a positive update, too, and that we are only hours away from his name being cleared. One step closer to being together, if we aren't already. But I quickly discover that Finch has not called, or even texted. Instead, I see a text from Polly. My heart sinks. The last thing I want to do is read her attacks. But you can't just ignore a message from your enemy. So I open it and read. Dear Lila, I am so sorry that I called you a slut. It was a really ugly thing to say, and I actually don't think that about you. I've just been really upset and confused about so much. But I did not take that picture of you. It was Finch and Beau, and I have proof. I also have something else really big to tell you. Will you please call me? Please, Lila. I'm desperate and scared and begging you. From the bottom of my broken heart, Polly. I finish reading, telling myself that she's full of shit, just trying to cover her ass and pin everything back on Finch because that's how bitter and jealous she is. The very definition of a hater. I tell myself to delete the text and erase every word from my memory. But I can't. And don't. Because deep down, I'm feeling pretty scared too. The afternoon crawls by as I read Polly's text over and over and over, believing her a bit more each time. What makes me feel so much worse is that Finch doesn't call or text. I end up falling asleep, with my ringer on high, just in case. Around 6 o'clock, I awaken to another text message from Polly. This one is a photo. I brace myself as I click on it, waiting for it to download, somehow knowing that it's going to be bad. But it turns out to be much, much worse than anything I could have imagined. Because it's another photo of me on Beau's bed. A close-up of my face, with a semi-hard penis resting on the bridge of my nose, pointing toward my mouth, almost touching my lips. At first, I think it must be photoshopped in. It's just so shocking and horrible and disgusting. But after staring at it a few seconds, I can tell that it's not. It's real. A real penis touching my face. I can't say for sure who it belongs to, but I think I may recognize it, along with the hand holding it. My heart shatters as another ellipsis appears, followed by a plea. Please, please call me. This time, I do. Polly answers, saying only, hi. But in that one syllable, I can tell she's been crying, probably for a long time. Where did you get that? I say, too shocked to cry myself. Did Finch send you that? No, it's actually a photo I took off his phone. They don't know I have it, she says, her words slurring together a little. They? I ask, even though I already have a pretty good guess who his wingman is. Finch and Beau, I found so many photos of them with girls, she says, including me. You? I say, floored. Yeah, and videos of me and him, too, she mumbles. Sex videos he told me he deleted, but they're all there, on his phone. Oh my God, Polly, I say, completely freaking out. You have to tell on him. We both do. No, she says. I can't. My parents would kill me. But we can't let him get away with this, I say. We can't. It's too late. What do you mean it's too late? I shout. The Honor Council meets tomorrow. It's not too late at all. I can't. I'd rather be in trouble for what they're saying I did than have my parents see all of this. No, I say. You didn't do anything wrong. You just had sex with a boy you liked. You don't know my parents, she says, her voice sounding oddly distant. I can't deal with this anymore. I can't. I just want to disappear. Forever. No, wait, Polly! I yell into the phone. But she's already hung up. My mind races, wondering what to do, just as I hear my dad call me for dinner. I suddenly want to see him, if only not to be alone, and practically run to the table. Voila, linguine and clams, he says when I get there. Just pretend they're not from a can, and the broccoli's not from a bag. I manage to force a smile, but of course he sees how fake it is and says, Are things really that bad? Yeah, Dad, I say, feeling shaky. Kinda. Yes. Talk to me, he says through the steam still rising from our plates of pasta. I want to tell him. I really do. I even take a deep breath and try to tell him. But I just can't. Not about this. I get one of my intense pangs of wishing Mom were around. Well, maybe not Mom herself, but a normal mother. Lila, what's going on? I shake my head, then tell him the truth. That I love him, and he's a great father. But this just isn't the kind of thing I want to talk with him about. I'm sorry, Dad. I expect him to get frustrated, maybe even angry. But instead, he reaches into his back pocket and pulls out a post-it note. He slides it across the table and says, Here. I look down and see Nina Browning's full name printed in small, pretty script. Under it is her phone number. She gave me this today. To give to you. Why? I say, picking it up. Surprised to realize that there is nothing I'd rather be holding at this second than Mrs. Browning's phone number. Dad shrugs and says, I guess because she's worried about you, and she likes you. She said you could call her. Anytime. Wow, I say. That's so nice. Dad nods and says, Yes, she is nice. Then he picks up his fork and suggests we eat. Dad, can I please be excused? I ask. He looks surprised and maybe a little disappointed, but simply says, Yes, go ahead. You can eat later. A minute later, I'm back in my bedroom, the note still in my hand. I dial her number. Mrs. Browning, I say when she answers on the first ring. Yes. Is this Lila? Yes. My dad just gave me your number. Are you busy? No, she says. I was just finishing coffee. I'm at Bongo, the one near you. Feeling overcome with relief that she's so nearby, I ask her if she'll come get me. I tell her that I need to talk to someone about Polly, that it's kind of an emergency, that I'm worried she may try to hurt herself. Her voice is calm and reassuring as she tells me she's going to hang up and call Polly's parents, and she'll head over to see me after that. Are you sure? I say, feeling guilty. I know it's getting late. I'm sure, Lila, she says. I'll be right there.
Chapter 28. Nina. After leaving Tom and Lala's house earlier this afternoon, I do not go home. I can't. Instead, I drive around again. Only this time, it's not quite as aimless. As filled with despair as I am, I have a vague purpose now, along with hope. I'm looking for somewhere to live after I move out, trying to imagine the beginning of a new, different life. I decide East Nashville really might be the answer. Not the only answer. I can actually picture moving back to Bristol for a while. Or maybe I'll get an apartment in Princeton, or wherever Finch winds up going to college. But if I do stay in Nashville, I want to be on this side of the river, with people less like Kirk and Melanie, and more like Tom and Lila. All I know for sure is that Finch is now my only real priority. And wherever I physically end up, I will do everything I possibly can to help him become a good man. The person I know he can be. As afternoon becomes evening, I wind up at the same coffee shop in Five Points where Tom and I first met. Our table is taken, but I sit at the one next to it, laying out the real estate brochures and newspapers that I've picked up over the day. I then pull a pen from my purse and start circling listings while I sip a decaf latte. I allow myself to dream a little about all the possibilities of a new life that could lie ahead for Finch and me. Then, just as I'm gathering up my things with thoughts of going home, my phone rings with a number I don't recognize. At first I think it might be a realtor calling me back, as I've contacted a few already. But when I answer it, I hear a girl's voice saying, "Mrs. Browning?" "Yes," I say. "Is this Lila?" "Yes, my dad just gave me your number. Are you busy?" "No," I say. "I was just finishing coffee. I'm at Bongo, the one near you." "Oh, well," she says, then blurts out, "Could you come get me?" "Now?" I say. "Only if you can. I'm just worried, and it's kind of hard to talk to my dad about this," she babbles, then uses the word emergency. Of all things, she says she's worried about Polly, that she may do something to hurt herself. "Why do you say that?" I ask, heading toward my car. "What happened?" "She's just really, really upset about some things," Lila says. I tell myself that teenage girls are prone to melodrama, and yet I can't help but think of some of the calls I've answered for Nashville Suicide Helpline, as well as the girl from Windsor who took her life. The very reason Kirk and I went to the gala the night of Beau's party. "Honey, let me try to call the Smiths," I say. "Then I'll head over to see you, okay?" "Are you sure?" Lila says. "I know it's getting late." "I'm sure, Lila," I say. "I'll be right there." In a low-grade panic, I hang up and log on to the Windsor directory, finding the Smiths' home and cell numbers. I don't expect them to answer, and they don't, but I leave multiple messages asking them to please call me. I add that it's urgent and about Polly. Then I start my car and drive back to Avondale for the second time today. When I arrive 5 minutes later, I see Lila standing by the street, her white high-top sneakers, light jeans, and a silver bomber jacket all glowing in my headlights. There's no way that I could miss her, but she still waves frantically at my car, then runs up to my window. "Hi," she says, out of breath. "Did you call Polly's parents?" "Yeah, I tried them, but no one answered." "She's not answering her phone either," Lila says. "Okay," I say, trying to stay calm. "I think I'll drive over there and knock on the door, just to be sure." Lila nods, then asks if she can come with me. For reasons I can't pinpoint in the adrenaline-filled moment, I feel relieved by the offer. Her mere presence. "Okay," I say. "Is it all right with your dad?" "Yes, I told him you were coming over, but I'll text him," she says, then runs around my car and gets in. The second her door is closed and her seatbelt fastened, she pulls her phone from her jacket pocket. As I do a quick 3-point turn, then make a right on Ordway, I ask Lila to tell me more about her conversation with Polly. I feel her looking at me as she hesitates, then says, "She told me that she has proof it wasn't her who took that picture of me, and that there are other pictures, too, of other girls." "What kind of pictures?" I say. "You know, embarrassing, sexual-type pictures she doesn't feel like she can tell Mr. Q or her parents about." As things start to come into horrifying focus, I clench the steering wheel to keep my hands from shaking. "Lila," I say, "did Finch take these pictures?" "Yes, along with Beau, apparently," Lila says softly. "I might not have believed her, but Polly sent me one of them tonight. It was of me and Finch when I was passed out, and it was really bad." "Oh, my God," I hear myself say, my heart shattering. As I press down on the gas pedal, I am bombarded with images of Finch. The perfect newborn baby sleeping in my arms. The spirited five-year-old making rutabaga stew on the steps of the Parthenon. The 10-year-old at the beach building sandcastles with Julie's girls, only half his age. I just can't believe it. What's happening now? The person my son has both slowly and suddenly become. And yet I do. Because sometimes you just can't see the things that are the closest to you. By the time we pull into Polly's driveway, my focus has returned to her and what we need to do in the moment. All the lights are on and two cars are in the driveway. I take it as a hopeful sign, although I can still think of a bad scenario too. What should we do? I say, as if Lila's the adult and I'm the child. I don't know. Go ring their doorbell? Lila says, just as a figure passes by one of the front windows. Is that her? I can't tell. It might be her mom, I say. We should probably just go find out, she says. Yeah, I say, but I feel paralyzed with fear. Lila, on the other hand, swings open her door and gets out of the car. I stare at her, marching toward the house, amazed by her bravery. I make myself follow, reaching her as she's ringing the doorbell, noticing how much her stoic profile resembles her father's. A few seconds later, we can hear someone coming to the door. I hold my breath, then stare into Mr. Smith's eyes. His first name suddenly escapes me. "Hello, Nina," he says, looking first startled and confused, then angry, but calm. "What brings you here so late?" As I open my mouth to reply, he shifts his gaze to Lila and says, "And you are?" "Lila Volpe, the girl from the photograph," she says, talking quickly and utterly matter-of-factly. "But we're not here for that, Mr. Smith. We're here because you and Mrs. Smith weren't answering your phones, and neither was Polly, and we're really worried about her." He furrows his brow and says,
"Worried how?"
Well, Polly called me earlier today, and she sounded really upset.
"She is upset," he says, shooting me a harsh look.
"Is she here?" Lila presses onward.
"Yes. She's in her room," he says,
now looking full-fledged pissed.
"But she has nothing more to say about this."
Meanwhile, Polly's mother appears over his shoulder. "Yes, none of us do," she says. "I know," I say, "and I'm so sorry for overstepping, but could you just check on her? Lila's worried that Polly may be in trouble." "Just what are you suggesting?" Mrs. Smith says, her voice ice cold, pushing past her husband. "I'm suggesting that your daughter may be trying to hurt herself," I say, my voice finally conveying my sense of panic. I watch as their expressions drastically change, both of them spinning away from us and flying up the spiral staircase. Mr. Smith takes the steps two and three at a time, his wife not far behind. I feel frozen again, but manage to turn and look at Lila, her expression mirroring the way I feel. 1 second later, we hear horrible shrieking. First them calling Polly's name, then frantic shouts for us to call 911. Lila finds her phone first, her fingers dialing those three dreaded digits.
"I'm calling to report an emergency," she says, her voice shaky but slow and clear. "I think someone has tried to kill herself. Yes, just now. A girl. 17. The address? Hold on."
She looks at me, wide-eyed with fear. I blank for the second time in minutes, unable to conjure even the street name. What is wrong with me, I think, as Lila heads right up the stairs, shouting,
"I need your address. I'm on with 911.
I hear more hysterical screaming than nothing. A second later, Lila reappears at the top of the staircase, wildly motioning at me.
"Mrs. Browning, you need to move your car. An ambulance is coming."
In a state of shock, I do as I'm told, running to my car, then back to the foyer, where I pace and pray for both Polly and Lila.
Chapter 29. Lila. It is totally impossible to process. Both where I am